are listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including habitat restoration, biomass power, and a county suing its own sheriff. I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
I'm Juliette Grable, environment contributor for JPR.
And I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
Juliette, we'll start with you. You just produced a really engaging and sound-rich feature, which we like around here, about a major habitat restoration project in the Upper Klamath Basin. Could you tell us about that project?
Sure. So this project is taking place in the Upper Klamath Basin at the edge of Agency Lake, which is the upper lobe of Upper Klamath Lake. And it's restoring wetland habitat to this area, which is extremely important for a number of reasons, including water quality, habitat for birds, fish, and endangered wildlife such as spotted frogs.
Yeah, sounds like an amazing project. What did they have to do to reconnect those 14,000 acres that you mentioned in your story of former wetland habitat to the Upper Klamath Lake?
So a ton of groundwork had to take place before they could breach the levees and flood or inundate these areas. And so some of the groundwork that had to take place were internal breaches in this 14,000-acre area. They also had to prepare areas for inundation so that erosion wouldn't take place once the water started coming in. So it was actually a big engineering project more than anything else.
Yeah, it's very impressive. What are the benefits of this project?
The great thing about this project is that there are multiple benefits. So for one, it'll increase storage capacity of Upper Klamath Lake significantly. That will mean that the lake will fill and drain more slowly over time. Water quality should improve. So these fringing wetlands are really important for filtering out nutrients like phosphorus. And historically, Upper Klamath Lake was surrounded by wetlands, but a lot of these were drained and diked for agriculture. So water quality should improve. These wetlands will also provide habitat for migrating and breeding birds that use the Pacific Flyway. As a lot of listeners probably know, this area is extremely important for migratory birds. And it will create habitat for two species of endangered fish, chuam and koptu, which are also known as suckers. And this should provide vital habitat for spawning and for the young.
Good. That's some good news this week. That's great. Who were involved in making this happen? What were the parties involved here?
So this project was a huge collaboration. Some of the major partners are Ducks Unlimited, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Klamath Tribes, but there were a lot of other partners involved in the planning and implementation too. BCI Contracting implemented the project. This is a Portland-based contractor owned by Three Brothers. Trout Unlimited is involved. They're an NGO that works a lot with local landowners. And private landowners are actually a big partner. Even though the area that was inundated is on federal land, there are subsequent phases of the project that will take place on private land and definitely require the cooperation of those landowners.
And in your story, you mentioned there's special significance to the Klamath people. Could you talk about that?
Sure. So the project's significant to Klamath tribes for a number of reasons. One takes place on their homelands. And so there were cultural monitors throughout the project who were on site witnessing any ground disturbance that was taking place. The project's also significant because it will restore wetland habitat, which is important for traditional foods, including plants, but also including these fish that I mentioned earlier. These fish are endangered, and they're really on the brink right now. What's happening is that the population as a whole is older, and the fish are spawning, but the young aren't surviving well. And so what that means is there aren't enough young fish to replace the older population as they get old and die out. And so we're in a really critical period right now. I was speaking with Chairman William Ray about this, and he said really the next 5 years are critical as to whether these species will survive or not.
And in your story, you describe a clever bit of engineering used in the project called a wave attenuator. What's that and what's so special about it?
Yeah, so the wave attenuator takes advantage of an existing east and west running dike. And so this whole area, just if you can kind of picture it as an overlay grid of canals crisscrossing this giant area. And so they took this existing dike and they supplemented it with material so that it slopes gently back into the wetlands that are to be flooded. And what this will do is break up any wave action. So Upper Klamath Lake is huge. And so you do have waves that are generated by wind. And these can cause a lot of erosion and bring up material from the bottom. And that would inhibit vegetation from establishing. So this wave attenuator is this big feature that will interrupt that wave action, allow vegetation to establish, and also keep the water quality better by keeping it clearer. And clear water can hold more oxygen than turbid water. And so that should be also good for aquatic creatures like fish.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. You mentioned that this is actually just the beginning part of a much larger restoration plan. What comes next?
Yes. Yeah, so phase one is wrapping up this year. And so there was to be another second external breach that may have already taken place. Those wetlands will be inundated. And then they'll go back and they'll do some seeding and planting of willows around that wave attenuator area. And that will pretty much wrap up phase one. Phase two and phase three will involve restoring two creeks that are north of the inundated area. Those are 4 mile and 7 mile creeks. So they'll be restored to their historic channels. There'll also be some upland restoration that takes place alongside of that, and that will take place partly on private lands.
Thank you very much, Juliet. Roman, turning to you, you covered a story about a biomass plant in Humboldt County that's really part of a larger conversation about renewable energy. What prompted this story for you in the first place?
Yeah, so originally I decided to do this story because I heard from these activists who have been opposed to this biomass plant for a while, mostly because of environmental climate concerns and then also the health impacts. They had heard back from the EPA. They'd emailed the EPA about some permitting issues related to the plant, and they said that this email proved that the biomass plant has been operating without a valid permit for years. I kind of get into the story why this is probably not the case, but that sort of prompted this whole look into the plant itself and the debate around it.
And for those who don't know, what is biomass power?
Yeah, so biomass power is essentially burning wood or other natural materials like crop waste or something to generate electricity. So this plant in Scotia, California, which is south of Eureka, burns wood waste from this attached sawmill. Scotia was actually a company town originally built up around the sawmill. I mean, I describe it in this story, but this pile of wood waste is massive. It's tall, as tall or taller than the houses that are right next to it. It's just this mountain of wood waste that they're burning.
Wow. So there's clearly two sides here. People that think biomass energy is carbon neutral and needed for the energy transition, and people who don't. So who's right here?
Yeah, so that's kind of what I get into in the story, is that both people are kind of right, kind of wrong in both ways. And, you know, biomass power is technically carbon neutral if you look at the facts, but in the long term, really. You essentially have to plant as many trees as you burn in order for it to be carbon neutral, because the new trees will suck up the carbon that's released by the biomass plant. But growing trees can take a long time, 20 to 30 years. And, you know, activists are saying that biomass power is essentially speeding up this natural process and releasing this carbon much more quickly than it would normally. And so that's why in the story, this activist Wendy Ring said that it's carbon neutral but not climate neutral or warming neutral, because, you know, when we're facing climate change, we have to think of a timeline a lot shorter than 20 to 30 years. And, you know, that extra CO2 in the atmosphere is going to be there right now warming the atmosphere, which could bring, you know, more effects and sort of a landslide effect going into the future.
And so is there an alternative for all this wood waste the sawmill produces?
Yeah, so there are some alternatives. It could be used for some other things. I didn't look into too much stuff, but, you know, Wendy Ring had mentioned using it as, there's this new technique for using it for wood fiber insulation instead of like fiberglass insulation in your home, which seemed really interesting. You know, they could also use a different type of biomass, their biomass plant. There's a different way of using this wood waste called a gasification plant. And basically, instead of burning the waste, that type of plant just heats it up really hot, and it creates this flammable gas that you can then burn to generate electricity, sort of like natural gas. It has, you know, less, it produces less power than natural gas does, but, you know, it's still this product you can create. And then a byproduct of gasification is also this waste called biochar, which is just charcoal. And you can use that in farming to increase soil fertility or other things. So gasification is also more efficient than directly burning the wood waste. But obviously that would cost money, and that'd be a very expensive project. It's not just like switching out some pipes in this plant. The lobbyist I talked to in California said that California has this big wood waste problem, that there's too much wood waste that we're getting from sawmills and cutting down these trees. There's, you know, even proposals right now to ship it overseas to Asia or Europe, which would just be worse for the environment. So they say that these biomass plants are an important way of dealing with this waste.
Great. And you know, one of the cool things about being a reporter is that you get to dip your toes into subjects that you don't initially know anything about and that are very interesting. What did you personally learn while you were reporting on this story?
I learned so much about biomass and just about the power system in general. I've reported on some electricity stuff before, but you know, I think there's a lot of conversations about baseline and baseload power in the coming years, because coal and natural gas plants have typically provided our baseload power, which is sort of this just like, you know, this is the base, this is the minimum amount of power we need, and then solar and wind and other renewables are kind of a bonus on top of that. And, you know, because solar and wind are intermittent, you can't really build a power grid on them alone. So some people say biomass power should stick around because it's technically carbon neutral and can provide that baseload power. You know, there's also other alternatives like geothermal or nuclear power, which are emission free, but they also have other challenges like cost. So we'll kind of have to see what happens with this biomass plant in the next five-ish years. This year, they're going to be going through this renewal process for the permit, and we'll see this new report about health impacts to the community.
Excellent. Thanks, Roman.
So, Justin, let's turn to you, because you covered the story about Curry County commissioners suing their sheriff. Why are they doing that?
Yeah, so the commissioners filed this complaint last week, and it alleges that Sheriff John War, the Curry County Sheriff, has refused to provide the county's legal counsel with documents. And according to the lawsuit, those documents detail things like county property and contracts, employment matters, and even potential liabilities for the county. So it also mentions that the sheriff hasn't been attending board meetings where things involving his department are being discussed, which I'll talk more about. And there's some history behind this complaint. So the Board of Commissioners and the sheriff's office have really been at odds lately. The sheriff's department has had its budget cut pretty dramatically and has lost a lot of deputies. And some are partially blaming the Board of Commissioners for that, although you know, also commissioners seem to have trouble getting the sheriff to do what they want. They actually passed an order last month to require the sheriff to hand over those documents and records that I mentioned, as well as provide duplicate keys to his office's county vehicles, which I thought was sort of telling as a sign of lost trust there. The lawsuit alleges Ward believes he has autonomous authority and is not required to obey that order. And it goes on to claim that Ward has entered into contracts that involve the county without providing specifics of those agreements. And this fight over the sheriff to provide records to the county has been going on for months, really. In September, Ward filed an Oregon State Bar complaint against the Curry County attorney, Ted Fitzgerald, related to these requests for documents. And he described in that complaint, he described those requests as a, quote, vendetta fueled by personal animosity. Ooh. The Teamsters Union, the local 223, which represents Curry County Sheriff's deputies, released a statement a couple months ago. They called the board's actions an overreach, and they basically blamed the board and their attorney for this conflict. So, yeah, the short of it is that the board and sheriff's department has not been getting along lately.
Yeah. And pretty quickly, you mentioned, you know, the sheriff's office budget has been cut. Can you tell us a little bit about how they've been struggling financially?
Yeah, I did a feature last year about their financial situation. They tried to pass a levy to fund the sheriff's department, and that did not pass. Voters in Curry County overwhelmingly did not want a new tax. And so that's what put them in this financial situation where they only have two or three patrolling deputies at this point, and they can't patrol 24 hours. So they're in trouble, and there's no solution on the horizon, at least.
Great. Thanks, Justin. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. You can find that on our website at ijpr.org, and you can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.